from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. More details on the new job in Ukraine for Vice President Joe Biden's son. We have this from RT.
And a son of the U.S. vice president has joined the board of directors of Ukraine's largest private gas producer. Hunter Biden now leads the company's legal unit, getting the position a few weeks after his father's trip to Kiev. And as Marina Portnoy explains, this could be more than just a coincidence.
Since the start of the crisis in Ukraine, Washington has provided unwavering moral and financial support to anti-government protesters, particularly those who spearheaded the uprising. Over the past months, Kyiv has received special visits from the CIA director, the Secretary of State, his assistant, senators, and most recently, U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, who recently crossed the Atlantic to assure Ukrainians that America's involvement in their crisis is sincere.
We, the United States, stand with you and all the Ukrainian people.
In time, democracy can be delivered to the Ukrainian people.
It is not just a foreign policy judgment. It is a personal, it's an emotional commitment as well by millions of Americans. As you attempt to pursue energy security.
Well, as it turns out, Joe Biden's youngest son will be conveniently playing a major role in Ukraine's pursuit of energy independence. Hunter Biden has been appointed head of legal affairs at Burisma Holdings, Ukraine's largest private gas producer. The U.S. vice president's son will also join the company's board of directors, consulting on matters related to international expansion and policies surrounding the country's economy. Critics say this is typical Washington politics, exploiting a foreign crisis for personal gain.
Now, of course, when the United States gets involved, as most every other country on Earth, if they get involved in some foreign adventure, they try to portray it in the most altruistic and platonic fashion possible. However, it's very difficult to disentangle business interests from national interests.
Vice President Biden has repeatedly accused Moscow of meddling in Ukraine's affairs, also insisting that America will help Kyiv reduce its dependency on Russia's energy. Mr. Biden just didn't mention that his own son and the U.S. would be benefiting in the interim. Reporting from New York, Marina Portnaya, RT.
Hunter, however, is not the only American on Burisma's board with close ties to the U.S. government. Devin Archer joined the gas company a day after Joe Biden's visit to Ukraine. Archer was an advisor to the now Secretary of State John Kerry during his presidential campaign in 2004, and the U.S. State Department said it wasn't troubled by the appointments when the issue came up at a briefing.
I'm wondering if the State Department has any concerns or any thoughts about the vice president's son joining the board of directors of this Ukrainian gas company?
No, he's a private citizen.
Do you consider that the Russian oligarchs who control, or the Ukrainian oligarchs who control these, they're all private citizens as well?
We certainly wouldn't put them in the same category.
No, I'm not suggesting that it should be in the same category, but I'm wondering if there are concerns from this building about the perception about how the Russians and or the Ukrainians would perceive the involvement of a son of the Vice President of the United States, especially given the situation.
No, there are not.
A mining disaster in Turkey has people out in the streets. We have this report from Press TV's Kovi Tavwe.
Turkish media reports say the government rejected calls to investigate mines in the Soma region only weeks before Tuesday's deadly coal mine disaster. Reports say the motion was submitted to Parliament last year by the country's main opposition, the Republican People's Party. This comes as the Turkish Prime Minister has traveled to Soma to offer his condolences to the families of the victims there. In a speech to the nation, Recep Tayyip Erdogan warned people not to fall into the trap of what he called extreme groups taking advantage of the situation. He said that Ankara has used all available resources to deal with the disaster and save those trapped underground. He also promised that all aspects of the incident would be investigated amid growing public anger over the slow pace of rescue efforts trying to save some 200 trapped miners. An electrical fault at the mine in Soma has left nearly 240 miners dead and 80 others injured.
The Syrian government is speaking out after the resignation Tuesday of the UN Special Envoy on Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi. Speaking to the press at the UN on Tuesday, Bashar Ja'afari, Syria's permanent representative to the UN, said Brahimi's admission that mistakes were made in his attempts to solve the crisis shows it's time to start re-examining the facts about the situation in his country and for those responsible to compensate the victims of the violence they helped perpetrate.
We shouldn't blame him for all the mistakes. Of course, he made some of these mistakes. Others made the rest of the remaining part of the mistakes. The American administration made mistakes. The French government, the British, the European Union, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, all of them made mistakes. And nowadays, nobody could deny these corroborated facts about this accumulation of mistakes made by all these foreign powers. Of course, the main mistake was this interference by these foreign powers into the domestic affairs of the Syrian people. No wonder that the European media is speaking now about 10,000 European terrorists from Europe only fighting in Syria. No wonder that everybody knows nowadays and speaks about how deeply the Turkish government is involved in facilitating, sponsoring, and training the terrorists crossing our common border with Turkey in order to be able to come inside Syria. No wonder that the French Minister of Interior today spoke about 277 French terrorists fighting in Syria, while the Reuters agency is raising the figure up to 767. So these are figures, they speak for themselves. These governments made huge mistakes to the Syrian people as well as to Syria as a whole. And we will not be satisfied only with apologies. These people should be responsible for paying the compensation for all this bloodshed they caused in Syria.
Ja'afari pointed to the contradiction in the way the U.S. views terrorism in Syria against the way it views terrorism elsewhere.
It's really surprising to see some people in Washington making also other mistakes. For instance, the American administration policy now considers Boko Haram in Nigeria, I mean the kidnapping of the 200 girls, innocent girls, as a terrorist group, while they are helping the same people in Syria, and they call them armed, moderate opposition. They are helping the terrorist groups in Syria, willingly or unwillingly, and they call them moderate opposition. But in Nigeria, they call them terrorists. The same terrorists in Syria kidnap girls and rape women, and they do exactly the same thing, and they abduct innocent people. So how come in Nigeria they are called terrorists and in Syria they are called moderate opposition, to which Washington is providing, as you know, weapons and financial support and political support?
He also spoke about a government program to end the fighting that is showing some results.
It's a very successful program, sponsored by the government. And every day, by the way, you don't hear about it. Every day, hundreds of people surrender and give themselves up to the government, and they are not prosecuted. There is a kind of a process agreed upon by the government as well as by the notables in some areas, so that those who surrender follow a special process of reconversion of these elements into the civilian life, and that's it. And that makes miracles, because many people are not, they were manipulated by the foreign interference, the petrodollars money, the political war, the media terrorist campaign. They were manipulated somehow. Now, after 3 years of the crisis, they open up their eyes and they know that something was wrong in their behavior. So it's by thousands of fighters who are surrendering themselves now to the government.
Ja'afari pointed to the role that Israel is playing in sponsoring terrorist activity in Syria.
Part of the reasons why Washington is supporting the so-called what they describe as moderate opposition, the terrorist groups they are supporting, is that this so-called armed opposition is linked to Israel. So this linkage between some elements of the armed terrorist groups and Israel is encouraging Washington to sponsor these groups. This is one of the reasons. The other reason, and it's not a secret anymore, is that Israel is helping the terrorist groups on the separation line. We drew the kind of attention of the Secretary General and his Undersecretary for Peacekeeping Operations many times on this, and there has been no reaction so far. Israel is treating the wounded of the terrorists in the Israeli hospitals. The Prime Minister of Israel is paying public visits to these wounded guys. And Israel is praising these elements. And not only that, Israel has, sponsored, trained, and hosted the new president of what they call Syrian Free Army, the new colonel, whatever. So he was in Israel for 10 months, treated by the Israelis and sponsored and trained and et cetera, et cetera, debriefed. And then they appointed him as a so-called new whatever. So Israel is deeply involved and still no reaction. No reaction from the Secretary General, no reaction from his undersecretary with this very alarming development.
Vitaly Churkin, Russia's permanent representative to the UN, said that although things are bad in Syria, there have been some developments of late that should spark some optimism.
First of all, I'm sure all of us are going to miss Lakhdar Brahimi. He has worked so hard to try to accomplish a breakthrough in a political settlement in Syria. Unfortunately, it hasn't happened so far, but we believe that the show must go on and that every effort must continue to be exerted in order to try to set the process of finding a political solution to the Syrian crisis in motion. And we do believe that there are some positive signs. Among them is the recent arrangement in Homs, a local peace arrangement. In fact, Mr. Brahimi spoke at length about it. One element of that arrangement is that various parties, the government, various opposition figures, international agencies, were working very hard for the same purpose of accomplishing that agreement. So we believe that that trend must continue. Of course, one would hope that it would not take the suffering and which the people in Old Town Homs have been experiencing for such a long time to do that. In order to try to develop a positive momentum even under current difficult circumstances, the Russian delegation has introduced today a draft resolution of the Security Council. Mostly it is on the humanitarian aspect of the situation, taking the experience of Homs as a point of departure, but also our hope is that it is going to help move ahead the political process in Syria. And we do believe that the third round of Geneva II conference must be convened as quickly as possible.
In Bahrain, more violent attacks on protesters. We have this report from Press TV.
Bahraini forces have once again clashed with anti-regime protesters who are calling for an end to the long rule of the Al-Khalifa monarchy. Well, regime forces fired tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse the protesters in the village of Erk. Bahraini cities and villages have been the scenes of anti-government protests in the past years on an almost daily basis. Activists say the protesters are preparing to hold a mass rally in the capital, Manama, in the coming days. The protesters are calling for the establishment of a democratically elected government. They also want an end to the regime's heavy-handed crackdown and the release of political prisoners. Ridwan Rizk joins us now via satellite from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Rizk is a political commentator who will share his insight with us on the situation in Bahrain. Mr. Rizk, we've seen persecution and prosecution of women and children and even medical staff, destruction of holy sites and reports of torture in prisons. How far are the Al-Khalifas willing to go to quell these demonstrations?
On top of what you've said, that the aggression and the against the Bahraini people, arresting the civilians, women, children, torturing in prison, people died under torturing in prison. They have arrested children, arrested women. It's all kind. They have this Bahraini regime. It seems went crazy and mad, don't know any more limits at all, at least respecting the minimum of the human rights around the world. They are violating their own people, the rights of their own people. And on top of what you've said, or what we have said, that they have been calling the martyrs' parents for investigations last couple of weeks. They are calling the parents, the mother and the father, and they held them for investigations, which is something new happening now. They are putting the parents also of the, you know, some young people who died in the streets against this regime. They are calling the parents for investigations. They are holding them under in prison for a couple of days. And this is something, a new way of acting by the Bahraini regime.
Six workers were injured when hot water spilled from a valve at the Kudan Kulam nuclear power plant in India's southern state of Tamil Nadu Wednesday. According to officials quoted in Reuters, there was no leak of radiation. The injured were reportedly carrying out maintenance work in the turbine building when the incident took place. More spying revelations, including an admission by a former director of the National Security Agency. General Michael Hayden admitted that the NSA captured phone metadata information and used it for drone targeting. Radio VR's David Kerens spoke with Beatrice Edwards, the executive director of the Government Accountability Project, about the significance of Hayden's admission and what it really means.
Well, it is confirmation of something that people had long suspected. When you look at what metadata tells the NSA about you, it tells the NSA essentially where you are, what is your location, and that is the information that's most crucial for orienting a drone strike. So it's not really surprising that that's information that's used for such a purpose. What is surprising is that Michael Hayden would actually say that and reveal the kind of executioner mentality behind the collection of this data and the weaponizing of electronic information that goes over the e-waves every day.
I take it we're meant to infer here that he's talking about data collected, metadata collected overseas, drone strikes overseas. It's not as though NSA is perpetrating this inside the country. Would it be stretching it to say that the NSA sometimes advises the government and they take action based on this metadata alone? That seems a little bit far-fetched. Or could it be the case that sometimes drone strikes proceed based only on this data without any extra context? Do we know?
We don't really know. I think, though, from what we know about how drone strikes are executed, that there's usually some kind of visual input also, that a drone strike would not be ordered based on electronic data from a telephone call alone. But again, that's just speculation. We don't really know.
There's a lot left to do, I'm sure, in terms of exposing, revealing the realities of U.S. drone warfare activity. Some of what's come out from the NSA on the NSA, we owe to whistleblowers. Mm-hmm. And I understand it from looking at the Government Accountability Project website that there's been more than one iteration or generation of whistleblowing inside the NSA. And if we go back before Snowden, there were quite a few instances where NSA whistleblowers from within attempted to discuss, reform, modify, or even clarify for themselves if the agency was overreaching its bounds. People like Tom Drake, Kirk Wiebe, Bill Binney. Can you talk with us a little bit about the prehistory of Snowden and how we got to the point where Snowden had to be so bold as to leave the country and reveal things from afar at great personal risk, that the system inside the NSA, not only the NSA, is not very safe necessarily for whistleblowers, although maybe it's gotten a little safer. Can you give us some context?
Yes, I think that's an extremely relevant perspective, because one of the allegations that is made so frequently about Edward Snowden's process of disclosures is that he should have used, or he could have used, internal channels safely. He didn't need to go directly to the press with the information that he had about NSA overreach. And my organization, the Government Accountability Project, represents a number of other NSA whistleblowers, including those whom you mentioned, and they were employed at the NSA. Bill Binney is a 30-year veteran of the NSA, so is Kirk Wiebe. Tom Drake started to work at the NSA on the unfortunate day of September 11th, 2001. But together, they, with one other NSA whistleblower, revealed to the Defense Department Inspector General, to the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, and to their superiors at the NSA, that surveillance programs in implementation, in operation at the time, were probably unconstitutional and probably fraudulent. It was likely unconstitutional because it was one of these seminal dragnet surveillance programs. Bill Binney and Kirk Wiebe were immediately transferred after they spoke to authorities in the NSA and in Congress about Trailblazer. They were put someplace where they would have very little access to external authorities, and they both retired very shortly after that. Tom Drake stayed on. He kept trying to disclose improprieties about Trailblazer. He ultimately went to the Baltimore Sun, but he did not reveal any classified information, nor did the reporter ask him for any. All of these whistleblowers were raided by the FBI. Their personal effects were taken. Their houses were searched and sacked for about 8 hours on the days of the raids. The personal possessions have not yet been returned, and Tom Drake was charged as an enemy of the state under the Espionage Act, investigated and put under intensive surveillance for 4 years before the case against him collapsed on the courthouse steps in 2011. He finally pled to a misdemeanor, I think, of unauthorized extension of the use of a computer. And Edward Snowden has told us that he knew exactly what had happened to these people who had tried to use internal channels, and he therefore did not pursue internal channels once his initial efforts to make internal disclosures did not prosper in 2012.
Meanwhile, Washington's spy versus spy games with Cuba took an unexpected turn in late April when the Cuban government arrested a group of Miami residents and charged them with a terrorist plot to overthrow the Cuban government. Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar spoke with Gloria LaRiva of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five about the case.
The fact that now terrorists who the Cuban Five had been trying to stop in the 90s are now in Cuba to carry out attacks on Cuba shows that, number one, Washington has given the green light for Miami terrorists to continue attacking Cuba, inside Cuba, without worrying that anybody will stop them. That's called impunity. The four Cuban right-wingers who were arrested in Cuba in late April and admit that they were sent to Cuba by the likes of terrorists named Santiago Alvarez, Osvaldo Mitat, and another man named Azugaray. These men have a long history of carrying out violent actions against people who simply want to have normalized relations with Cuba, either who travel to Cuba, who are Cuban, and who advocate normalization of relations. This is what these terrorists do.
What is the U.S. government saying about these arrests of admitted terrorists in Cuba? And what does this new revelation mean for the freedom campaign of the Cuban Five?
I think the U.S. government right now is quite surprised that Cuba was able to arrest these terrorists inside Cuba. There has been no word yet from the U.S. government. They're probably trying to figure out a way to explain what's taken place. It's interesting. The Cuban government has called on Washington to cooperate with Cuba in order to process this new arrest, in order to help. In other words, Cuba wants the U.S. to act against the main terrorists inside Miami who financed the men who infiltrated Cuba. We'll see what happens with that. In the meantime, the Miami Herald has published a major article in which they actually quote one of the terrorists, Santiago Alvarez, inside of Miami, and let him say that he had nothing to do with it. They're trying to give him a voice inside Miami to try to absolve himself of what the men who've been arrested in Cuba admit, that they were sent by Santiago Alvarez and his accomplices.
Who is Santiago Alvarez?
The man who's been financing terrorists, mercenaries, to go into Cuba to carry out attacks. Santiago Alvarez is very well known by the U.S., and yet they let him run free in Miami. He has a long history of financing the most notorious terrorist in this hemisphere, Luis Posada Carriles. In 2001, Santiago Alvarez was caught in Miami with two major warehouses of high-powered weapons. He paid several men that same year to take a boat to Cuba. He gave them C4 explosives, and he instructed them to use those explosives to blow up the famous Tropicana nightclub, where hundreds of people can be gathered in any evening watching the entertainment. So these are men who planned and still planned to carry out major damage on the island, to kill as many people as they can. And Cuba had a right to protect itself in the 1990s by sending the Cuban Five patriots to stop this kind of terrorism. And so it shows, what this is all exposing is that the U.S. government supports terrorism against Cuba using U.S. tax dollars to try to destabilize Cuba either through terrorism or through these social media networks trying to create a whole parallel underground communications network inside Cuba in violation of international law and in violation of Cuban and, in fact, U.S. law.
Can you tell us something about the issue of the U.S. government's cyber war, the use of high-tech and social media to try to undermine the Cuban Revolution?
In March and April, there was a major expose by Associated Press, an investigation that took place involving Freedom of Information Act petitions, and the Associated Press reporters helped uncover an extremely extensive underground, undercover, secret operation by the U.S. government through the USAID financing, really a CIA operation against Cuba, involving the development of a Twitter-like program in order to capture potentially hundreds of thousands of names, contacts of people who have cell phones inside Cuba. And primarily it was directed against the youth of Cuba to try to corral them into unknowingly into a Twitter-like kind of account that the U.S. would begin, according to their plan, to send first innocuous messages by text over cell phones to Cuban people who did not know where these emails came from. They were texts that said, for example, oh, there's a concert that's going to take place, or a little cute joke or something. The name of this CIA program is called Sunsuneo. It's named after the Sunsun, which is a Cuban hummingbird. This is only one of several programs by the U.S. using social media to try to influence large sections of youth and others inside of Cuba to turn against the Cuban government. Apparently, this program failed after a while. This seems to have been a lack of funding, but it's a dangerous attempt by the U.S. to try to, once again, carry out another tactic against the Cuban Revolution.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.